So I expect to be making quite a number of mistakes over the next few weeks, and I expect to be hearing about them from you, but I thought I might mention a mistake that I've already made, because you couldn't possibly know about it. I thought it would be very easy, like towards the end of preparations, to just sort of look through some lock and find some quote that seemed to sort of like cast a favorable eye toward the kind of project that I'm engaging in, and maybe sort of give a hint of what that project was like. But the more I read, the more I realized that Locke's writings, at least some parts of them, look like they're actually kind of an enormous warning against anybody trying to do the kind of thing that I'm wanting to do. And so on the principle that, against the principle that, you know, first impressions are really count, I'm going to give you the worst possible first impression of what I'm talking about by reading the following quote from Locke. It is, and I hope you'll still be able to get a sense of what I'm talking about, horrible though it may appear under this guise. Okay. It is not safe to play with error and dress it up to ourselves in the shape of truth. The mind by degrees loses its relish of real solid truth, is reconciled insensibly to anything that can be dressed up into any faint appearance of it. And if the fancy be allowed the place of judgment at first in sport, afterwards comes by use to usurp it. And what is recommended by this flatterer is received for good. There are so many ways of fallacy, such arts of giving colors, appearances, and resemblances by this court dresser, that he who is not wary to receive nothing but truth itself cannot but be caught. So, be on your guard. All right, so I'm going to start with some stories. One or two of you may have heard them before. The first is a conversation I had with my daughter that I found very frustrating. And in some ways, this whole project begins from my attempt to not get too mad at my daughter. It goes like this. Zena says, "You never take me to Friendly's for ice cream anymore." Friendly's is ice cream store. I said, "Didn't we go last week on your birthday?" Which is true. We went with about 10 of her friends on her birthday. And then she said, "I wasn't talking about that." And I thought, this, you may not have been talking about that, but still, you know, if you make a generalization and somebody gives a counterexample to it, you can't say, "Well, I wasn't talking about the counterexamples." Well, maybe you can. Let's keep on going. So here's another family member. When she was on the job market for the first time, presenting her work on her ideas about identity through time and persistence through the gain and loss of properties, would usually, like in her interviews, kind of preface her spiel with, you know, something about, "I'm going to be talking about properties because it's actually a convenient like format in which to sort of deal with the issue of change. But I don't really, you know, I don't really mean that to be taken terribly seriously. It's just sort of a way of talking." And one of the interviewers, that's famous philosopher FP, one of the interviewers said, "Well, hold on a minute. This is in interviews, it's a good policy to only say true things. And you do know that we on the East Coast have like a lot of argument. We're from Berkeley. A lot of arguments to show that properties don't exist." And then it sort of got worse from there. And after a whole lot of back and forth, the end of it was, "Well, we on the..." Yeah, so Sally asked what some of those arguments were, and he said, "Well, I shouldn't have to tell you. I mean, you're, you know, applying for a metaphysics job." And then after a lot more of this, Sally said, "Well, I guess I might as well mention that we on the West Coast have refutations of all your East Coast arguments, but I wouldn't condescend to you by telling you what they are." So we all know what's going on here, and then she continued with the interview. Anyway, so you can see this is sort of sneaking up towards philosophy. Now it's going to get a little bit closer, because around this time I discovered this wonderful paper by Joseph Ullian and Nelson Goodman called Truth About Jones. And it starts with like a courtroom scene where the... Falstaff is the attorney for the defense. Jones is on trial. Lupoli is the attorney, and Lupoli says, "Falstaff's testimony demonstrates the innocence of my client, Jones." And the judge then says, "You do realize that Falstaff's testimony was false. I mean, the name was a hint. You realize it was false." And the attorney says, "It was false, and it was about Jones, but it was not false about Jones." And, you know, and then pandemonium ensues, and they clear the courtroom, and the guy has the weekend to sort of, like, explain how that could possibly be true together, and then eventually he does, and I'm basically expanding on some of the things that Goodman said in that paper. So here's the general form of a semantic excuse. You say a thing that is or may be false, but it's partly true. It's true at what it says about such and such. And that's what you were speaking to. So there's this notion of true about such and such, and its relation to partly true. And there's probably various versions of partial truth, and I might mention a number of them along the way, but I want to just sort of focus on a particular one right now. What would be the naivest possible idea about partial truth? Well, if a thing is like partly red, you might think, well, actually, not, I didn't think of this before, and it probably isn't true, but if a thing is partly red, you might think that it has a part that's wholly red. Forgive me if that's wrong, just pretend. You might think very naively that if a statement is partly true, that's on account of having a part that's wholly true. And that's a very kind of naive thought that you might be inclined to scoff at. Then here's a more kind of conservative sounding thought. We have to explain, if we're going to use this notion of partial truth, what it is for B to be part of A. Well, the natural thing to say is that B is part of A if it's implied by A. So I want to maintain that of these two, the kind of naive and foolish looking one and the kind of sober and philosophically right thinking looking one, that it's the naive one that's right. A hypothesis is partly true if it has wholly true parts. And it's the one that just sort of seems obvious, B is part of A if it's implied by A, that's actually wrong. The one that I'm saying is wrong is about the relation between part or containment and implication. And so it might be good to look back at some of the things that have been said in the history of philosophy about containment. And I'm sure there's been a lot. I know of only at least I'm only going to mention two, Kant and Wittgenstein. So Kant famously on analyticity liked to say that truth is analytic if it predicates of the subject something that was already contained in the subject. So vixens are foxes is analytic because to be a fox is part of what it is to be a vixen. Here's a quote from Alberto Caffa. By analytic means, we recognize in something no more than we had already thought in it. We recognize better what we already knew. That's the relation between analyticity and analysis. Analytic truths kind of reflect your success at having teased out part of what the thing on the left-hand side really was. But of course, if this is how we understand analytic truths, then synthetic truths are truths that predicate of a subject more than what was contained in it. And that sort of sounds like a way of being ampliative. And ampliative sounds like a way of like not being sort of certifiable by exercise of reason or semantic competence alone. It seems as though you're going to have some experience to see whether the extra element in the predicate really does attach to the subject. And hence was... So it would seem like these non-analytic truths would have to be empirical, but some of them seem not to be empirical, like truths of geometry and truths of arithmetic, and now we're started on the problem of how a priori synthetic a priori knowledge is possible. Now, Wittgenstein in the Tractatus suggests that a valid argument merely unpacks what was there in the premises. Deduction on this kind of view would seem incapable of teaching us anything new. And that it does sometimes seem to teach us new things, or we sometimes seem to be able to acquire new knowledge by means of deduction, is a problem, if indeed the conclusion was already there in the premises. I guess this is the passage from the Tractatus. If P follows from Q, the sense of P is contained in the sense of Q. And then he says, a proposition already asserts every proposition which follows from it. Okay, so Kant and Wittgenstein. Kant's view has gone by the wayside. Truths whose predicate ranges outside of the subject, maybe they're ampliative in some sense, but not really a sense that requires them to be substantive. So there's this one conceptual relation of inclusion. The subject contains the predicate. But why shouldn't other conceptual relations be able to play this role as well? Like exclusion, like red things are never green. I believe actually Kant did allow that as well, even in the passages where he's talking about containment. But we can talk about sort of relations that aren't really even between two concepts. There's just like intra-conceptual relations, like sort of transitivity properties of certain concepts. If X is taller than Y and Y is taller than Z, then X is taller than Z. That would seem like it's analytic and not because of containment relations among concepts. And then finally we have what seem to be analytic truths that aren't obviously based on conceptual relations at all, more like sort of structural facts of some kind, like, you know, something made everything, then everything was made by something. So Wittgenstein's version has actually fared quite a bit better than Kant's, which is interesting. We're still tempted to think of the conclusions of valid arguments as really already there in the premises, and we're still tempted to scratch our heads about how valid argumentation can extend knowledge when the conclusion was already, in effect, known. And so just as a historical matter, with apologies to real historians, you might ask why this difference in reception? Is it that nobody actually spotted Wittgenstein's mistake here, the way Frege supposedly spotted Kant's by realizing that there's a lot more analyticities than Kant supposed? But in fact, some people did spot Wittgenstein's mistake, if you want to call it that, right around the same time. So Moore in the Commonplace book, which says, to say that cat's mew contains cat's mew or dog's bark, is to give a false partial analysis of cat's mew. This disjunction, though it logically follows from cat's mew, is not a part of, contained in, included in, the proposition that cats mew. So Moore is suggesting that some implications, like conjuncts implied by their conjunctions, are cases of logical containment or some sort of containment, and others, like disjunction implied by a disjunct, aren't. Ramsey says the same thing in his review in Mind of the Tractatus. He says, Wittgenstein is speaking of Wittgenstein's idea that conclusion of a valid argument is contained in the premises, he says, Wittgenstein is proposing an extension of the meaning of assert. Sorry, I meant you've already asserted the conclusion when you've asserted the premises. An extension of the meaning of assert only partly in conformity with ordinary usage, which probably agrees as regards P and Q. And P, in other words, you do seem to have, among other things, asserted that P if you assert that P and Q, or for all X, FX, and FA, but not otherwise. So let's try to run a little bit with these worries that Moore and Ramsey had. So a paradigm of inclusion, it's starting to seem, is conjunctions containing their conjuncts. So snow is white and cold contains snow is white. A paradigm of non-inclusion is a disjunct not containing a disjunction that it's part of. I mean, I shouldn't say part of, but it's one of the disjuncts of. Now, that just sort of like seems intuitive, or hopefully started to seem possibly intuitive the last few minutes, but it's just like this kind of weak, shaky intuition, and you might think that these might be paradigm cases, but those kinds of intuitions like have been known to lead us astray before. Maybe we shouldn't take them too seriously in this case, but I want to argue that there's a fairly systematic phenomenon here whereby parthood really does have an explanatory role to play that requires it to be different from implication. So I'm going to just mention a bunch of things where it kind of seems like a notion of part might be helpful. The first is actually corresponds to this notion of implicitly asserting or asserting in part that Wittgenstein uses and Ramsey uses and Moore also uses. So to say that snow is white and cold is to say, inter alia, that snow is white, right? But, you know, if I say snow is white and cold, you can correctly report me. Of course, reporting practices are crazy, but certainly you can correctly report me as having said that snow is white. But if I said snow is white, it would be very misleading without further context to say, well, I have it from Yablo that snow is white or cold, right? Not only, well, for one reason, because someone might use that on a premise of an argument whereby they denied the first disjunct to get the second disjunct. So it might seem as though saying that transmits down to the parts of what is said, but not to mere consequences that aren't also parts. I'll use that phrase, like mere consequences, for consequences that aren't also parts. Agreement. Hempel, Carnap, and Popper, sort of in the classic age of confirmation theory, when people were sort of wondering about theoretic relations between different theories and the extent to which they agreed or disagreed and the extent to which one that went beyond another, they all separately said, without citing each other, that the shared or common content of two hypotheses, A and B, is A or B. In other words, you might think intuitively that it happens sometimes, but not usually when people speak the truth, that they actually are agreeing on something. But according to this view, whenever, actually, never mind true, almost whenever two people say anything, with one exception, if one of the statements implies the negation of the other, they're agreeing on something, namely the disjunction of the two things that they said. And this seems kind of over the top. Really, the shared or common content of A and B ought to be the parts they have in common, not the implications they have in common, because the implications are just too easy to come by. Priority. So I'm going to complain about the use of the word consequence in logic. I think a case can be made that not every kind of implication deserves to be called a consequence, because sometimes A implies B because B is a precondition of A's truth. So for P and Q to be true, P has to already be Q. It's not as though we say, oh, here's P and Q, and let's see what we can pull out of that. Ah, I just found P, right? In other cases, the word consequence really seems to fit in that the implication really does seem logically downstream from the thing that's implying it. So P or Q seems logically downstream from P. Nobody would say, don't push me too hard in this form of words, but okay, I've got P or Q, so I'm halfway to the truth of P. I mean, you might have that dialectically if you're trying to establish that P, but it's not in any real sense that P or Q is sort of getting at half of what you need to get at to explain why P is true, because you might have got there by just getting Q to be true, which has nothing to do with why P is true. Falsification. So the falsity of a conjunct seems to nicely explain the falsity of the conjunction. You know, if a part is contaminated, that explains why the whole is contaminated. But the falsity of a disjunction, P or Q, seems to only ensure or guarantee the falsity of the thing that implies it. And it makes sense. In general, we say if something has a problematic part, then the whole kind of inherits the problem, right? But the part actually confers like this defective quality on the whole. But if something with a problematic consequence, that consequence could just be a symptom of the falsity, not any part of it. Permission. So permitting someone to eat pork chops seems like it's permitting them to eat pork. But that doesn't mean that having permitted someone to eat pork, you've permitted them to eat pork or human flesh. Go ahead, kill the fly, I might say to you, saying if you want to kill that fly, go ahead. You couldn't say, well, he said I could kill something, so I'm going to kill you, right? Kill the fly seems like it doesn't, in a strong sense, entail you may kill something, right? Because you may kill something suggests that there's a certain amount of freedom you have as between the various possible victims. Confirmation. So actually, why don't I just skip confirmation? So knowledge. So seeming counterexamples to the closure principle for knowledge almost always target entailments that are not parts. So to take Dresky's example, he suggests, not everyone agrees with this, it's probably wrong, but you can see the idea. It's a zebra is known, but it's not a cleverly disguised mule, right? It's not known. Well, it seems significant there that it's not a cleverly disguised mule brings in this whole new kind of issue of mules and disguises and all that, okay, which wasn't there in the premise. And you could well imagine that the claim is somehow like exposing some more flanks that are attackable and by bringing in this new kind of subject matter. If you look at it's red and it looks red, right? It seems funny to infer from that my color vision was accurate on this occasion. In other words, suppose I look at a thing and I see it, and by sight I can tell that it's red, and then I remark, oh, it also looked red to me, so therefore it looked exactly the way that it was, and so my color vision was on this occasion accurate. Well, again, it seems like a new subject matter. That has seemed funny to some people. It seems like some new subject matter is being introduced. There is no mention of color vision in red and looked red. Similarly, with like the Kripke dogmatism paradox, I lock the door entails perhaps that evidence to the contrary is misleading, but there's nothing in I lock the door about evidence to the contrary, and it comes as somewhat of a surprise that you get that kind of conclusion from that kind of premise. Okay, and then finally, to come back to what the real interest is here, partial truth. So snow is white and contains sugar, seems like it inherits partial truth from the fact that snow is white. But one doesn't want to say that snow, say, contains sugar is made partly true by the fact that snow contains sugar or is white. One doesn't in general want to say that P becomes partly true by virtue of implying the truth that P or Q, or there's nothing that doesn't have some truth in it, right? Which can be useful in certain contexts, but it's not really what we think. There are some views that are thoroughly false, but on this view there aren't, because you can always entail, you can always draw a consequence that's in fact true. It's one that doesn't draw at all on the thing that you started from, but nevertheless, it is a consequence. So it seems as though true parts confer partial truth on the whole, but mere consequences seem to lack this power. Okay, so let's look a little bit at what this notion of logical or content part might be, if indeed there's more involved in it than implication. So what is the X such that parthood is implication plus X? And there might seem to be a clue about this in the Goodman story, in that the judge, actually I didn't mention what Lupoli says when he comes back and talks to the judge on Monday, he says, Falstaff said a lot of things. He said some things about Jones and also some things about Smith. When I said that Falstaff's testimony was partly true, I meant it was true in what it said about Jones. He misdescribed Smith and correctly described Jones. And so subject matter seems to be playing a big role in what's involved in the partial truth of Falstaff's testimony. You can look at everything that testimony was about, and then you can sort of cut back a little bit and look at part of what that testimony was about, and it might have been right about that part, even if it wasn't right about the whole. And that seems to be part of what's involved in what Falstaff's saying about how it is that Falstaff's claims about Jones are part of what he said overall, and therefore in a position to sort of confer, to reflect back favorably on the whole of the testimony. So to identify content parts, I want to suggest we'll have to broaden our focus from truth conditions to what sentences are about, their subject matter. I don't want to try that just yet, though, because anything that one might say about subject matter at this point is going to seem kind of controversial and perhaps made up for the occasion in order to get the right results about partial truth. So I want to take a more direct route to content part and partial truth that doesn't mention subject matter. And then when we come back around to subject matter again, we can sort of ask ourselves how well our story about that sort of fits with this direct route thing. So here's an idea about parts as such. It's more like a schema. It applies different ways in different cases, but it applies surprisingly often. So I call it difference transmission. So for Y to be part of X, what does that mean? Or what's involved in that? I'm not sure this is a constitutive claim. In some cases it might be, some cases not. But if Y is part of X, then it seems as though there's changes that Y can't undergo without X also undergoing those changes. I mean, it's clearest for like a material object part whole. So if the frame is part of the bicycle, right? You can't bend the frame while leaving the bicycle just the way it was. And in general, if you look at intrinsic properties of a material object part of a material object whole, it seems like they can't change without the whole changing in its intrinsic properties. So there you have upward transmission of intrinsic properties. You could look at sets, ignoring, worries about the essential properties of sets and they're having their members essentially. It seems plausible that part of what's involved in one set containing another as a part, the part being the subset, is that if you screwed with the membership of the subset, you will thereby have screwed with the membership of the whole thing. You can't change the membership of a subset. Actually, I should be a little more... I mean, you can't bring in a brand new thing and put it in the subset without having that brand new thing appear in the superset as well. With pluralities of objects, it seems as though almost both of those are transmitted upwards. So if I talk about like the ducks and the water birds, on the one hand, for the ducks to be part of the water birds, and this corresponds to sets, every duck has to be a water bird, but it's also the case that you can't have the ducks flying south while the water birds like stay in the north. Okay? Changes in the properties of the subplurality seem like they're bound to sort of make themselves felt at the level of the superplurality. So Those are the easy cases. Now I'm going to start sneaking up on where we want to get, so start getting suspicious. Suppose X and Y are properties. Then I want to say what transmits up from the part to the whole is how the properties are possessed, the way the properties are possessed. So take being positively charged and being charged. Intuitively, being charged is part of being positively charged. You might not agree with that if you have a certain intuition about being charged, but I'll just assume that you do. Being charged is part of being positively charged. So according to this difference transmission schema, what that means is certain changes with regard to charge are going to sort of bubble up, percolate up to the level of being positively charged. So a thing that's 2 coulombs goes to 3 coulombs, it increases in charge, but you can't say, oh, but it stayed the same in positive charge. If a positively charged particle changes in charge, then it changes in positive charge. Okay? And that seems to be part of what's involved in charge being part of positive charge. If I said, take a case of non-parthood. So charge does not contain, say, charge or weighing over 5 kilograms. A thing can change in how it's charged or weighing over 5 kilograms by weighing more without any effect on its charge. Okay, so that would be a case of the weaker property changing in how it's possessed via the extra disjunct that was thrown in, while the first disjunct continues to obtain in the very same way. Then you don't get the percolation upward, which is what you'd hope if indeed this was a good heuristic for parts and wholes. And again, you could say regularity contains polygonhood because, you know, if a thing is polygonal, it can't change. Suppose it's also rectangular, it can't change in how it's polygonal while staying rectangular in the very same way. Conjunctive properties and conjuncts is probably the easiest case. Differences in how a sapphire is blue or grew percolate up to how it's blue and valuable. Or grew and valuable. Actually, I should have mentioned grew before because it's a property where one has a very strong intuition that this is the kind of thing that can be had in 2 different ways. You can be grew by, I can never remember the ways exactly, but examined before T and found to be green, or not examined before T and actually blue. And when Goodman comes along and says, oh, look, you can recover green from grew and bleen, you know, because green is whatever, grew before T and bleen after T, one could argue that, well, those might be necessarily equivalent properties, but they differ in the following way. To be green, the ways of being green are to be, you know, emerald green or etc. But the ways of being the other thing actually mention T, you know, you were grew before T or you were bleen after T, something like that. So that would be an example. That's like a first sighting of what might be a possible application of this kind of framework to issues of hyperintentionality. There you've got necessarily equivalent properties that might still seem in this very subtle way different. They agree in whether they're had, but they don't always agree in how they're had. Okay, well now we're getting up to statements or propositions. With properties, I said, say, blue and grew percolate up. How a thing is blue or grew percolates up. With statements or propositions, and I think the fact that this rhymes adds to its credibility, it's true that percolates up, right? So I'm just continuing in the same way. I want to say how the implication is true should percolate up to how the implier is true, if the implication wants to be considered a part of the implier. So take Alexander Learn's logic. That seems to be part of Alexander Learn's logic and conquers Asia. That seems not unrelated to the fact that cross-world changes in how Alexander Learn's logic make for changes in how he learns logic and conquers Asia. Whereas, if you consider he learns logic or conquers Asia, is that part of he learns logic? Well, the disjunction could be differently true because of a change in how, because he conquers Asia more quickly. Okay? But that need have no ramifications for how he learns logic. So that's an indication that this conclusion is somehow swimming in sort of foreign waters relative to the premise, and the temperature can change in these other waters while it isn't changing back home where the premise was. Okay. So here's a proposal. I'll say about this, as is probably true about almost all these numbered claims that I make that seem like they're like official and are supposed to be correct, that this probably isn't quite right, but it sort of gets us down the right road. I want to say one statement. I'm not going to like worry at this point too much about statements, sentences, propositions, because that's just a kind of fastidiousness that will just, you know, you remark it each time and then it doesn't really make a difference. Later it might become important. So I'll just say statement. B is part of A. If one, A implies B, and two, changes in the way B is true or false require, call for changes in the way that A is true or false. You know, before coming back to subject matter, let me say a bit about this point that I mentioned earlier, that there might be sort of an angle on hyperintentionality in this way of thinking of part-whole relations among properties. So one can start with an extensional theory of properties, the kind that sort of Quine suggests. A property is just like a set of actual items, the things that have the properties. Okay, so property of being green is the set of green things, etc. And Quine makes the point, not that he's looking for a more kind of fine-grained notion of property, but he makes the point, I guess he's really talking about meaning, but he makes the point, he's also not looking for a better notion of meaning, he makes the point that, look, take renates and chordates, right? Creatures with a kidney and creatures with a backbone, they're exactly the same creatures. I assume someone has checked that, and that's true. So extensionally, if you had an extensional theory of properties, it would be the very same property, but we don't really think that having a kidney is the same property as having a heart. Okay, well, that might lead you to go for, as David Lewis does, an intentional theory of properties that brings in possible objects. Okay, so sets of possibilia, if you're a modal realist. But the worry here might be that necessarily coextensive properties need not be identical either. I just gave the possible example of, you know, green and the Grubb-Lean kind of compound. I should also say the following. I give almost all the examples I give probably, arguably, don't quite work, but I hope they get us close enough to the territory that you'll think something like this might be right. So here's an example. So Berkeley suggests, in Principles Concerning Principles of Human Knowledge, that a thing can't be extended without being colored or at least having some sensible quality or other. Okay? And let's suppose that he's right about that. A thing can't be... I'll use the word colored in a broad sense for sensible qualities, whatever they might be. Suppose he's right about that. And suppose it's also true that a thing can't have sensible qualities without being extended. This doesn't seem like completely outrageous to suppose. Well, then it would seem that being extended is necessarily equivalent to being colored or sensible qualitied. But they don't really seem like the same property. Well, here's one way of making out why they're not the same property. What are the ways of being extended? Square, triangular, circular, cubical. Okay. What are the ways of being colored? Red, green, yellow. These are very different. So that could be a clue to why these properties strike us as different, because we're somehow seeing through the extension to the sources in the natures of the particular exemplars of how they got to have that property, so to speak, or what it is about them whereby they have that property. So actually, I got ahead of myself. So a hyperintentional theory distinguishes properties that are even necessarily coextensive. The most familiar way of doing this is to sort of bring in a little bit of structure. David Lewis explores this possibility. He says, so for example, we could distinguish, if you want to, being charged from being positively or negatively charged by saying that the second actually has a disjunction in it. And it has negatively charged in it and positively charged in it. And they're all put together in a certain way. So that would be a sort of a structural way of distinguishing necessarily equivalent properties. So a few complaints about this. First is, look, so far we've been proceeding along a certain axis. We're trying to make properties more fine-grained by looking at something about how they're had. Like what has them, what must have them, things of that nature. Structure just seems like a complete left turn. You're not continuing the sequence in the same direction. That's not such a big deal. But it's worth thinking about. The second worry is that structure slices too fine because, and this is a point that Frege made long ago, that although one does oftentimes want to distinguish, say, in he says it about sense, you know, logically equivalent statements, but where the equivalent sort of bubbles up from quite different structures, it's not clear you want to distinguish A from not A, or A from A and A. Okay? But if you're doing it on the basis of structure, they're just as different as anything else. Okay, so structure slices too fine. It also doesn't slice finely enough, because it only works when there is some underlying structure to uncover. And you might well think that there isn't in being colored or being extended. Those aren't obviously, you know, disjuncts of various ways of having them. They just sort of seem like simple monadic properties. Okay. So then the suggestion I want to come back to is, look, properties aren't only instantiated in this world. They're not only instantiated, if you're willing to talk this way, in other worlds. They're also instantiated in this world in other ways, in certain ways. And the way this can help with fine-graining is that properties that are exactly alike with respect to whether they're had in this world or others might still differ in how they're had. I just gave the example a minute ago. Colored by way of being blue, green, transparent, maybe, you know, sticky if you want to bring in other sensible qualities. That's not the way it is with extension. Okay, so I want to say hyperintentional properties. I actually make no use of hyperintentional properties. I just sort of mentioned this as a possibility. Hyperintentional properties are instantiated by individuated by what instantiates them and how. And this is actually an intentionalist spirit, because if you think of an intentional property just like a set of possibilia, what you're adding when you get to the hyperintentional properties and you're bringing in the ways that, say, being colored is had, is just a bunch of subsets of that first set. You're just still working with sets, right? So colored is a bunch of things in a big set, and then, or say, red is a bunch of things in a big set, and then scarlet is a subset, and crimson is another subset, and so on and so forth. So you're really using the same resources as before. So the extent that you thought that only those resources were like legitimate, you shouldn't have any further objection. You're just going up one level in the set theoretic hierarchy. Okay, so in the same way, I want to suggest that an extensional theory of properties will identify the proposition that S with, sorry, go back through the same sequence. An extensional theory of propositions, like Frege's, says, not that he puts it this way, proposition expressed by a sentence is just its truth value. An intentional theory of propositions would say that the proposition expressed by a sentence is the function mapping worlds to its truth value in those worlds. Okay, that's an intention. A hyperintentional theory identifies the proposition that S with the S worlds, the set of S worlds, understood as qualifying in such and such particular ways. Okay, now I'm just going to like rattle off a list of a few. This like chart below that's in like footnote size print is just like my latest kind of guess at what might be some necessarily equivalent sentences that seem to us to differ in some level of meaning that actually can affect truth value when they're embedded in larger contexts that might kind of yield to this kind of treatment. But I'm not going to try to argue that they are. So, obvious example, you know, all crows are black, all non-black things are non-crows. They're not necessarily equivalent. Hempel worries a lot about this. Well, you can certainly see ways of embedding these that where they don't contribute the same way. So if I have a black crow in front of me, Rudy here, I say, Rudy here is an example of why all crows are black. But while Rudy might be a piece of evidence for all non-black things are non-crows, he doesn't sort of bear it out. He's not part of why it's true. It's not about him. Plus, I'm a scientist and I'm really like audacious, and I set myself probably unmeetable goal. I say, I want it to be the case that all truths are known. I want to know every truth. Okay, so compare all truths are known to nothing unknown is true. When you think about how do I bring it about that all truths are known, I try to know more things. When I think about how to bring it about that everything not known is true, I think of destroying the elementary particles that are good counterexamples to my thesis. Okay, familiar example: King of France is bald. Seems like has the same modal profile as a bald person as the King of France. But the King of France is bald strikes us as hard to evaluate. A bald person is the king of France. Actually, Kian gave me this example about 10 years ago. I may not remember. Seems like it's false. Okay, I might say, how am I to tell if a bald person is the king of France? I'll tell you how. Get all the bald people into a room and ask them if they're kings. Right? Now, how am I to tell if the king of France is bald? I don't know. You can't get the king of France into a room. Okay. She appreciates that she is lost. She is right to think that she is lost. Those arguably are true in the same world, where she has a belief that she's lost and she's right. But suppose we embed those two sentences after, it's a good thing that, or fortunately, it does seem fortunate, given that she's lost, that she appreciates that she is lost. But it doesn't seem fortunate, given that she thinks that she's lost, that she's right to think that she's lost. That's bad, right? Hopefully, it would be better if she was wrong to think she was lost, right? Then maybe she'd get home faster, okay? So that's these two sort of are supposed to differ in that what the one presupposes, the other one asserts, and what the other one asserts, the other one presupposes. Okay, so here's some like more speculative examples that are kind of fun. So on a certain understanding of the phrases the rich and the poor, and getting richer and getting poorer, the rich keep on getting richer is true in the same world as the poor keep on getting poorer. I won't like go through how you have to think of the rich and the poor for this to be true. But you know, it's something to do with like commanding a larger percentage of the national income or something like that. It's divided between, let's suppose the rich is like the top half of incomes and the poor is the bottom half of incomes. Well, the rich can't command more without the poor commanding less, right? But if I say, look, I know from my own bitter experience that the poor have been getting poorer, I can't probably also say, I know from my own bitter experience that the rich have been getting richer because I'm not rich. Right? Example of, oh, here's another example that from a book by Kahneman. Again, this probably needs more work to make it work. So you might think, here's a puzzle. Why is it that very highly intelligent women tend to marry less intelligent men? Is there some lack of nerve involved? What's the reason for that? Why don't they have the self-respect to marry someone just as intelligent as themselves? Well, here's another statement. Spouses are not always equal in intelligence. If you study the phenomenon, which I have not sufficiently studied, of regression to the mean, you will realize that those are equivalent. That whenever you have something that's sort of above average, and it's got to sort of be paired off with something else, most of the time, it's going to be paired off with something not as above average as it, because there just aren't as many things like that, right? There's another example like this. So you'd have to, again, put in more like hidden premises and stuff, but she did exceptionally well on that exam, and she probably won't do as well on the next, she'll probably do worse on the next exam. The one seems like a wonderful thing. The other one seems worrisome. But on a certain understanding of exceptionally well and worse and so on, they would be equivalent. An example of John Hawthorne's. It was a Rolex. It was a real Rolex. Now, there aren't any unreal Rolexes, right? The Rolexes are the real Rolexes. But nevertheless, if I say, well, if it hadn't been a Rolex, what would it have been? A Timex, right? If it hadn't been a real Rolex, it would have been a fake Rolex, right? The two are the same. Okay. Here's an example that half me, half Kit find. Suppose we're in the Garden of Eden, and there's like infinitely many apple trees, and one of them is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and there's only finitely many apples on that tree, and God speaks to us and says, well, there's two things that God could say. The first thing, the second thing on the sheet, probably what God did say, or more in the spirit of what God did say, you can eat infinitely many of those apples other than those on the tree of knowledge. Here's another thing God could have said. You can eat infinitely many of those apples. Okay? Well, here's two necessarily equivalent hypotheses. You eat infinitely many apples, and you eat infinitely many apples apart from the 15 on the tree of knowledge. Those are necessarily equivalent. But permitting you to do the one seems like very different from permitting you to do the other. If I say you can eat infinitely many apples, and you pick one off the tree of knowledge, I can say, okay, well, that falls under what I said. But if I say infinitely many apart from the tree of knowledge, and you take one of them, I can't say, I won't say, okay, fair enough, right? I've specifically exempted the tree of knowledge from what I was giving you permission to eat from. Okay. Aboutness in history. So I want to say that subject matter has been relatively neglected in philosophy. So how many times have you heard someone reject the analysis of P as a phi, some longer condition phi, on the ground that, you know, here's a scenario where P holds and phi doesn't hold. Knowledge can't be justified true belief, because here's a scenario where you have the justified true belief and you don't have the knowledge. But even if P and phi are true in the very same cases, there might be the following worry. The subject matter is wrong. P is true for different reasons from the reasons that phi is true, or P obtains for different reasons from the reasons that phi obtains. How often have you heard a philosopher argue like that? This is not a good analysis of P because they hold for different reasons. I say how often. Let me give a few examples where people do actually argue like this. But you might sort of think about how common an occurrence it is. So Frege rejects his early treatment of identity statements. How can Hesperus's phosphorus be an informative statement, given that it seems to say that a thing is identical to itself? His early treatment is, well, it really says in some way that the name Hesperus is co-referential with the name phosphorus. And you know, it might well be true that it's necessary that Hesperus's phosphorus is true if and only if the name Hesperus co-refers with the name phosphorus. But still, we don't like that, Frege later decided, as an explanation of, so to speak, what it is for that sentence to be true, because Hesperus's phosphorus, that sentence, is not in any way about names. It's about planets, and therefore an accounting of its truth conditions that brings names in seem like it's getting the subject matter wrong, even if it gets the satisfaction conditions correct. Frege himself, although sensitive on this first point, has sometimes been objected to on the basis that he does the very same thing himself with existence. So what is it for Pegasus not to exist? It's for the concept of Pegasus to have no instances. But you might well think that Pegasus doesn't exist is not in any way about the concept of Pegasus, right? It's about, well, this is not so easy to say either, but it seems like it's truer to say it's about Pegasus. Certainly it's not about the concept. That's how we feel. Kripke has the famous Humphrey example. Against counterpart theory, he says Humphrey could care, which says that, Humphrey is possibly F if and only if there's a possible counterpart of Humphrey, which really is F in its world. Kripke says Humphrey could care less whether someone else would have been victorious in another world. And people often sort of complain, no, Kripke, you didn't really understand what the counterpart theorist was saying, because counterpart theorist wasn't saying that the possibility of Humphrey winning the election is the same as the possibility of some other guy winning the election. No, it's what it is for Humphrey to win the election is further to be the possibility that the guy in that world where the election is won is a counterpart of Humphrey. But you could also interpret Kripke a different way, as not denying that the counterpart theoretic analysis tells you something about Humphrey, but as pointing out that it also brings in a guy who is not Humphrey. And you might think that in saying, I'm not sure I do think, but you might think that in saying that Humphrey could have won the election, you're not talking about anybody else. Well, I suppose you're, obliquely talking about the people that vote in the election, but you're not talking about a very Humphrey-like guy in some other world who isn't Humphrey. This is an example from the discussion of constructive empiricism and von Frassen. Von Frassen, there's a lot of ways of formulating his theory, but he basically wants to say that, scientific theories are successful if they're empirically adequate, and they're empirically adequate if they correctly describe observables, if they get the observables right. Okay, and then one wants to get an explanation of what it is for a claim to be about observables. And you might think, and von Frassen does sometimes talk this way, well, we know what an observable is. It's a thing you can observe. Right? But the sun is a thing you can observe, and facts about nuclear fusion are facts about the sun. But von Frassen doesn't think, right, that a theory has to get nuclear fusion correct to get observables right. And so this leads Elliot Sober to ask what is the characterization of aboutness that von Frassen has in mind? Here's one final example. You know, the claim, it might be that phi, is often understood to say that phi is compatible with some contextually indicated body of information. But imagine a case like this. The building is on fire. We're all out in the street. We look around. Where's Bob? He's not here. We're worried he might be in the building. What is it to worry that Bob might be in the building? Is it to worry that there are limits to your body of information? I'm not sure. I don't think I'm worried about my body of information. I mean, it might be the limits to my body of information that are causally implicated in my worrying, but I feel like I'm worried about Bob and whether he's in the building, not about any relation to bodies of information. Okay. So, let me talk about some views of aboutness. It's made quite a bit simpler that the three main papers, well, the first one is called About, second one is called About, and the third one has the word about in the middle. I'm not telling you the rest of it. So Ryle in 1933 has a paper called About. His example is Jones climbed Helvellyn. And he suggests that this is about, he says a lot of things. This is just one thing. He says it's about Jones and it's about Helvellyn. Why? Because Jones climbed Helvellyn contains names of those individuals, or terms that refer to those individuals. So the theory seems to be that a sentence is about what is mentioned in that sentence, where mentioning is, you know, having a name that, or a referring phrase that refers to the thing. Difficulty with this that Nelson Goodman points out in his 1960-something paper about. He says, look, take a claim like everyone climbed Helvellyn. That doesn't, in any obvious way, mention me. There's no expression in there that refers to me. But it seems to be about me. Because I didn't climb Helvellyn, it's false that everyone climbed Helvellyn. So he has an idea, Goodman says, well, look, maybe a sentence is about a thing if the sentence mentions the thing or some entailment of the sentence mentions the thing. Because everyone climbed Helvellyn does entail Steve climbed Helvellyn, and that does really mention me. Okay. But now he worries that every sentence is going to be about everything. Because Jones climbed Helvellyn entails that Jones climbed Helvellyn, and Sparky is identical to Sparky. Sparky's my dog. Okay. But Jones climbed Helvellyn is not at all about Sparky. Okay. Goodman has a further idea. Maybe a sentence is about a thing if it mentions the thing, or it selectively entails something about the thing. So in other words, it entails a sentence mentioning that thing such that it doesn't entail the universal generalization of that sentence. The problem with Jones climbed Helvellyn and entailing Jones did that and Sparky equals Sparky is that it equally follows that everyone equals everyone. For, you know, putting that in as a second conjunct, and so, et cetera, it goes on and on. A difficulty. Let's move on to Lewis. David Lewis has a paper called Statements Partly About Observation. He talks about sentences like, to begin with, say, the sun is hot. What's that about? The sun. Subject matters on this view are kind of a part of reality, maybe a spatio-temporally bounded part of reality. He calls that a part-based subject matter and begins to worry that not all subject matters are indeed part-based. Some of them might concern an aspect of reality rather than a little kind of compact compartment or part of reality. So he considers the statement, there are primarily many stars, or there are infinitely many stars. What's that about? Well, it's not some little part of reality where the number of stars information is like treasured up, waiting to be the witness to the truth of, the number of stars is prime or large. It's sort of scattered all over the universe, so to speak, that aspect of reality, how many stars there are. So he says, look, we need a different kind of theory of how many stars there are, or the number of stars. What kind of thing is that? And he suggests it's an equivalence relation on logical space between worlds. You give a subject matter of this kind, or indeed of any kind, by saying when two worlds are just alike with respect to that subject matter. So the number of stars is the relation between worlds whereby worlds are related that way just in case they have equally many stars. And as a bonus, you can also bring part-based subject matters into this picture as well, because you could also treat, say, the sun as an equivalence relation on worlds. Worlds are equivalent if they're just alike with respect to what's going on with the sun. Okay. So he starts thinking of subject matters as equivalence relations or partitions of logical space, ways of dividing everything up into these different cells. Here's a possible worry. Suppose I consider not just a billion stars exist, but about a billion stars exist, or a billion or so stars exist. You might think that at least one of the things that's about is, say, the number of stars, give or take 10, or give or take 100, or 1,000, or a million. But the number of stars, give or take a million, isn't a partition, because you can have one world that's within a million of this of another world, and the other is within a million of this world, but these two are more than a million apart. So if you want to have a subject matter like the number of stars, give or take a million, it can't be an equivalence relation, because equivalence relations are transitive. What do you get if you knock transitivity off the definition of an equivalence relation? You get similarity. Okay. So maybe there are similarity relations, and there's kind of a thing that corresponds to similarity relations the way partitions correspond to equivalence relations. They're called, I call them divisions. Okay, so that's so far it's kind of parallel. It's just a slightly more complicated set of subsets of logical space. You might think even this is not good enough, because you might think that one thing about similarity relations is that the cells corresponding to them, they're all incomparable. None contain any other. Okay, but you might think that sometimes a subject matter should be a way of carving up logical space so that you have some of the cells are subsets of others. So suppose we take, red and blue stars exist. One cell here might be one where there's, let's just say, red stars and blue stars. Okay, another might worry about the ways the different stars are red. So it might distinguish worlds where the red stars are crimson and the blue ones are cerulean or something. Okay, etc., etc. So this would be a subset. The set of worlds where there's red stars has a subset. The set of worlds where there's crimson stars. Okay, so that's a final thing that subject matters could be. It's the most general thing I'll consider, and in fact I'll normally just go back to similarity relations and what I just called divisions of reality, but these correspond to what are sometimes called a cover of a set. A cover of a set is a set of sets whose union is the original, it contains the original set, but I'll just suppose it is the original set. So the most abstract notion of subject matter that I'll consider is it's a cover of logical space, a way of like piling on it's a cover of logical space. Okay. Well, these definitions witness the fact that I wasn't able to give you sort of a concrete illustration of what this would be like, may seem too structural and abstract. You might think a subject matter should tell you how matters stand in a given world, in particular our world, where that subject matter was concerned. And you might think that these, like equivalence relation or similarity relation type things, just do not do that. But that's just wrong. They do. Because the cells of a partition, going back to Lewis's way of doing it, the cells are sets of worlds. What are sets of worlds for Lewis? They're propositions. So the cell of the number of stars, that subject matter, that our world is in, is the set of all worlds with n, exactly n stars, where n is the number of stars in our world. What is that set? It's the proposition that there are n stars. Okay? So you actually are, despite the structural appearance of all this, what comes out of it is a story of what any given world is like in respect to the subject matter in question. What it's like is the sets of worlds in the subject matter that contain the world in question, because those are all propositions. Okay, so one thing that's nice about the structural conception, so I'll try to do it in 10 more minutes. So one thing that's nice about the structural conception is that it lets you define interesting relations. So one subject matter is orthogonal to another one, Like, suppose you're talking about something and somebody like mentions something completely irrelevant. You say, that's completely beside the point. That's, well, you might not say this, but it sort of sounds right. That's completely right angles to what I was talking about. I guess you wouldn't say perpendicular. You might say orthogonal. Okay, what does that actually mean? Well, it means how matters stand with respect to the one is completely independent of how matters stand with respect to the other, which in a set theory sense is each cell of the one intersects every cell of the other. You could also define, if you had a notion of part, which I'll come to, what it is for two subject matters to be disjoint. They're disjoint if they have no parts in common or no non-trivial parts in common. Part whole, the definition, kind of changes a little bit with your conception of subject matter, but there'll all be variations on this theme. So subject matter, boldface N, I'll use lowercase boldface letters for subject matters. N is part of M if, first of all, each N cell contains an M cell, and each M cell is contained in an N cell. That fudges a certain issue. You can ask me about it if you want. So the basic idea is the larger subject matter subdivides the cells of the smaller one. A bigger subject matter is one that it's harder for worlds to be just alike with respect to it. Right? So if I say the number of stars, that's smaller than the number of stars and their sizes, because two worlds could be just alike with respect to how many stars there are, but they could all be bigger in this one world. Okay, so you're going to subdivide the cell containing all the worlds with like a billion stars according to how big those stars are when you get to this larger subject matter of the number of stars and how big they are. Okay, sentences. At some point along this path from Ryle to Goodman to Lewis, we lost sight of sentences because Ryle is talking about what's the subject matter of a sentence, what is a sentence about? But when you get to Lewis, you're really getting a theory of what subject matters are considered as entities in their own right. And we'd like somehow to recover this interesting issue that Ryle began with of what is the subject matter of a sentence. Lewis says one thing about this. He says, a sentence is wholly about a subject matter if its truth value supervenes on which cell of the subject matter you're in. So the number of stars is a billion is wholly about how many stars there are because there's never variation in whether it's true or false as between worlds with equally many stars. Okay, there are red stars is not wholly about the number of stars because you can have worlds with equally many stars that differ in whether they contain red stars. So we've got this notion of being wholly about. S is wholly about M if it evaluates the same in M equivalent worlds. But we might want something further. We might want the notion of what is the subject matter that a sentence is about. This doesn't give you that, because a sentence is wholly about lots of subject matters. The largest subject matter every sentence is about is what everything is like in every possible respect, the partition that puts every world into its own cell. Okay? Certainly, there's only one world in each cell. The truth value of the sentence cannot vary between worlds in a cell. There aren't worlds in a cell. You might think then, okay, what about the smallest subject matter that a sentence is wholly about? But if the definition of wholly about is there shouldn't be variation in truth value within a cell, then the smallest subject matter is just going to be whether or not S, the two-cell subject matter that puts all the worlds where S is true here and the ones where S is false there. So here's a diagnosis of what's going wrong with this approach to what a sentence's subject matter is. The word wholly and wholly about S could be understood in reference to S, or it could be understood in reference to M. In reference to S means there's nothing in S that isn't about M. S doesn't raise any issues that aren't, so to speak, decided by where you are M-wise in logical space. But you might also be interested in putting the wholly, applying the wholly to M. You say, there's nothing in M beyond, there's nothing in M, so to speak, that S doesn't concern. So what everything is like in every possible respect, that contains a lot of stuff that most sentences don't concern. So that's why it's too big. So we've got to try to get at this notion of exactly about, where the sentence, so to speak, isn't too big, it doesn't contain extra stuff, and the subject matter also isn't too big, it contains doesn't contain extra stuff. So I'm going to assume that the subject matter of a sentence, call it bold S, small s for sentence S, ought to be the least subject matter meeting some kind of a boundedness condition, just the way that kind of Lewis led us to speculate. The condition S is wholly about a subject matter. That's just too weak, because you wind up with this two-cell subject matter that has all the S true worlds here and all the S false worlds there. So things can stand any number of ways where the subject matter of a sentence is concerned, whereby the sentence has the same truth value in those worlds. So let me give an example or two, and maybe seeing how this goes wrong will give us a clue. So the world will end in fire or in ice. Okay? Take a world where it ends in fire, take a world where it ends in ice. Well, yeah, might not be quite the same end of the sense of world. But here's where it ends in fire, here's where it ends in ice. It's still true in both of those worlds, okay? But somehow we want to count these worlds different with respect to the subject matter of the world will end in fire or ice. One more example, and then we'll come back to trying to diagnose it. Take the sentence, the U.S. President in the year 2001 is a senator's son. And consider two worlds. First is the actual world. In the actual world, the president in 2001 is George W. Bush. He's the son of George H.W. Bush, who, in addition to having been president, was a senator earlier. So it was true that the U.S. senator in 2001 was the president was the son of a senator. But here's a nearby world where if Al Gore won the election, Al Gore's father was a senator too. Okay. What was his name? Al Gore Sr. Okay, so these are two different worlds. These two worlds are different with respect to the subject matter of the U.S. president in 2001 is a senator's son. Okay, I have this conceit of which I can't seem to get rid of, although it's hard to see that it could really help anything. I say, imagine a trans world reporter on the S beat who's like traveling around logical space reporting back to headquarters if anything changes where the subject matter of a sentence is concerned. If you go from a world where Bush wins to a world where Gore wins, you're going to report back, oh my God, you know, something has really changed with respect to this issue of the U.S. president being a senator's son. So why is a change in the personnel newsworthy? Why is a change in the witnesses newsworthy? Well, because it's a change in how it is true that the U.S. president is a senator's son. The witness to an existential generalization is the answer to how is this existential generalization true. So this connects up a little bit with the talk earlier of how a sentence is true. So here's a proposal based on this. The subject matter of S, the one that it's exactly about, is the, and I'll treat it as a similarity relation, or it doesn't really matter for these purposes, it's the relation such that worlds are dissimilar or go in different cells if S is differently true in them. How it's true varies between the two sentences. So you say what a sentence is about by kind of structuring logical space according to S's varying ways of being true. Okay? So you sort of, yeah. There's an issue with this, which I'll just mention. It's a polarity issue. Consider a world where a sentence is false. Presumably it's false because of how matters stand with respect to its subject matter. But the way I just defined subject matter, there is no particular way things stand with respect to its subject matter because it's only the true world that got carved up. And there's a couple of other worries like that. So answer, let's throw into an overall subject matter the thing I just called the subject matter, how and why S is true, or S's different ways of being true, we'll throw in its different ways of being false. We'll call those two together the overall subject matter. This also has the nice feature that a sentence and its negation wind up having the very same subject matter. There's these two things, and they just kind of, what I'm calling the subject antimatter of the one is the subject matter of the other, and vice versa. Okay. Content part. So one gives a sentence a subject matter by carving up logical space according to its ways of being true or false. Larger subject matter corresponds to the finer carving, the one that makes it harder for worlds to be just alike. So you get eight. B is part of A, just if the argument A therefore B is first, this is definitely got to be part of it, truth preserving, A has got to imply B, But second, about mispreserving. S's subject matter should include the subject matter of B. And when you throw in what we said earlier about sentential subject matter and how it's made up of ways that things are capable of being true or false, this becomes B is part of A if A implies B, and changes in how B is true force changes in how A is true. So changes in how Alexander conquers Asia force changes in how he learns logic and conquers Asia, or how it's true that he learns logic and conquers Asia. If we call these ways of being true and false by the name truth makers, not attaching any more importance to that than I've just done right now, then we get B is part of A if A implies B, and B's truth makers are implied by truth makers for A, and likewise its false makers are implied, or falsity makers are implied by false makers for A. Okay, I'm getting pretty near done. Yeah, so let's say I'm entirely done. And questions? Sometimes reality corresponds. Anyway, yeah, so I'm done.